Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you all to today's edition of All Sides Weekend, where we talk about books. It's hard to believe this is the first book show of 2020. So welcome. Belated Happy New Year to you and to everybody else. I am delighted to have Cassie Rose with us, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog, which is necessary and a joy for anyone who loves to read, is thelongestchapter.com. And Chris Hickey is Director of Youth Services at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Library. She brings us, each time she comes, the library's latest quick picks. I should mention that later in this broadcast, we are going to welcome Michelle Herman to the show. She is from the Department of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. She will bring with her Dan Coyce, an editor at Slate. Dan's new book, which has been named one of the best travel books of the year of 2019 by the New York Times, is called How to Be a Family, The Year I Dragged My Kids Around the World to Find a New Way to Be Together. So I want to know all about that. But I digress. Good morning. Happy New Year. We begin, Cassie Rose, with a little bit of a controversy in a book called American Dirt that both of you were talking to me about before we went on the air. What is American Dirt and the book by Jeanine Cummins?
American Dirt is a novel that came out this week. It's about a family. It opens with a very violent scene in which a drug cartel comes in and basically wipes out a family because the journalist, who is the husband and the father of the woman and the son who become the protagonists of the novel, has written about the kingpin. So to come after him in punishment, the family and the journalist, they take out the family, except the little boy is hiding in the bathroom with his mother, and they are able to escape. This takes place in Acapulco. The mother is a bookseller, and so this is, I would say, a middle-class family and having just a normal life, except for the fact you don't mess with the cartel. So they are on the run to safety, which is the American dirt. So this is an immigration story.
Why is NPR all over this book? They are. And there's been a lot of newspaper coverage. There's been a significant amount of controversy about this
Correct.
Book. What's going
yes.
on?
The problem is that the book in intention succeeds. And I have not read the book. I want to at least to say that. But I've read a lot about it and also a lot about the controversy. I think the problem is that the book's intention is good, and that is to say, to bring to light the immigration experience. The execution fails epically. And if anyone wants to get a very good, in my opinion, a very good review of the book is the one that Parul Segal wrote in the New York Times on January 17th. She came out and said, I'm going to take one for the team here. And what she means by that is she was going up against the 800-pound gorilla of the cheerleading that has been going on about this book for a couple months. Everybody has been praising it. The author got a 7-figure advance.
Which is, I mean, unless you're someone
Stephen
with a huge
King.
Track, Stephen King, mm-hmm. a 7-figure advance is not every day. Am I correct?
That's correct. And so that's part of the controversy. So the Latin American authors, the readers, I would say Latin American population, and probably immigration experts are coming out and saying this book is a page-turner, but it does not fairly represent the immigration experience. The characters are predictable. The hero are stock characters. The villains are stock characters. And yes, maybe you're turning the page, but it gives a very poor and inauthentic representation of the immigration experience.
But we discussed earlier Don Winslow, who was a middle-class white guy who writes devastating novels that mm-hmm. On these topics, and nobody's complaining about him. So I'm gathering that the writing may not be all that great in American Dirt. Is that what people are trying to say?
Correct. But I think that actually it is what I often say is the mother of the monster. So they're all going after the monster now, and they're crucifying the author.
Yeah.
And she's really not, in my opinion, not the one who's at the most fault here. She all along has been saying, in her acknowledgments and even interviews, I read that she questioned whether or not she should have been the one writing the book because she has not lived that experience. However, fiction writers do that. They go into another world. I think the mother of the monster here is Flatiron Books, which is the publishing house. So my question is, where is the editor who read the book and said, great page turner, but I need you to go back and rework these characters? Or the publicist and the marketing, or the lawyers at Flatiron Books that said, you know what, this is a very hot issue. Let's get an expert on immigration to read
this. And yet here we are talking about it on the radio, and it is getting all kinds of publicity you can't buy. So there's that argument as well. The book is called American Dirt. I suppose people have to make up their own minds. The author is Janine Cummins, and it is very controversial. Even Oprah got involved, apparently, in this conversation.
It's the Oprah Book Club. Choice now, and that's also causing a lot of controversy.
She came out for it, obviously, if she chose it for her book club.
She did.
I wish she'd choose one of my books if I wrote any. But Chris Hickey is here from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. Chris brings us each week the quick picks of the library, which very briefly you'll review what quick picks are.
So quick picks are the hot books, like American Dirt, because that is a quick pick, and went the first day we put it on the display. So finding that book on the shelf will be a challenge. So the quick pick are the hot books, the ones with really long hold lists, the ones that are bestsellers that you will likely not walk into our building and find. You'll have to reserve it. But this collection of books is on a display. Those books do not go out to fill reserves. And so the idea is that you will walk into one of our buildings, the book you've been waiting for is right there and you can check it out.
And it works. It works
great. It does work great.
And you change the displays every Tuesday morning, is my
understanding. Every Tuesday morning.
And this is library-wide, all the branches.
Yes, every branch does the same thing. So that's when all of the new content comes out every Tuesday. We put it out there for you.
Okay, so tell us about a quick pick that's really hot right now.
Oh, gosh. So the hottest one, and it just became a quick pick this week. It is called Why We Can't Sleep, The Women's New Midlife Crisis by Ada Calhoun. So there was an article in the Dispatch about it. I'm a Gen X woman. This is about Gen X women and why we can't sleep at night. I'm a Gen X woman. I have trouble sleeping at night. So yes, I picked up this book. So it talks about the pressures, but it talks about culturally where Gen X is, and the parts that I'm reading now talk about our childhood and the things that we experienced and were exposed to and what that means for us today. So one of the things she talks about is the Challenger explosion. So when we were children, that was, you know, a shocking, horrible thing that happened.
You were a child. I wasn't
a
child.
Okay. I was in seventh grade, and some of the kids in the school watched it. My class did not, but we heard an announcement over the loudspeaker that the Challenger had exploded. And then we went along with our day. You know, we didn't talk about it. Counselors didn't come in. Where today, when something horrible happens, you know, schools will talk about it. You know, kids will express how they feel. Mm. We didn't do that. And so she's saying that did have an impact on us. She also talks about how we're the generation that was the first to be inundated with marketing at a high level because we watched a lot of television. I mean, a lot of television. So she talked about almost the clockwork orange way of conditioning where, you know, we know these jingles inside our head. And so as I'm reading this book and she talks about, you know, Slinky, and it's like, oh, yeah, I know that jingle. You know, what is your baloney's first name? It's OSCAR. You know, we have this conditioned and we remember all of these commercials probably more than the shows that we were actually watching.
Is this what's keeping you up at night?
It's not. But she's probably going to get to that point.
But she's articulating things that really are, I guess, pounding in people's brains at all hours of the day and night as one lives one's life.
And what she's saying is, you know, that the Gen X was the first generation. Now, the boomers built, the women went to work, they empowered us, and it was awesome. But then our generation was the first to grow up where that was an expectation. And so the pressure was on. And so what women are finding is now I'm in my 40s and I'm not having, you know, the impact on the world that I thought I was going to. You know, I haven't done all the great things that I was planning on doing. And what does that mean? And it's keeping people up at night. It's causing, you know, one in four women, according to this book, are on antidepressants.
Well, when you talk about this book, is there a specific age group the book is aimed for? I mean,
yes.
And I mean, she give me a number about, if you don't mind.
Yeah, she's so Gen X, born between 1965
okay.
and 1979, is pretty much what she's talking
I'm like
about here.
Gen L or M.
You're a baby boomer.
I'm a boomer. Right?
Yes.
So okay. The name and the
title is Why We Can't Sleep: The Women's New Midlife Crisis by Ada Calhoun.
And that is a very active,
a quick pick
apparently.
It's gone very quickly.
Right. So look for it or be number 1500 on the reserve
list.
But the library does, for titles like this, the library does have lots of copies. I've never had to wait a long time for an enormously popular book. I mean, it's maybe a couple of weeks, but not that I forgot that I reserved it.
No, we continue to purchase more copies. So we look at the hold list, and we do have a ratio that our selectors use, and they will continue purchasing books to fill that demand.
You're listening to All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, talking with Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic, and Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. All right, Cassie Rose, you brought it with you. You brought Chicago by Brian Doyle. I sat there, read it, cried, and laughed for 2 weeks. Talk to me.
Well, actually, I picked the book up because of a conversation that you and I had, and you had read Brian Doyle's collection of essays.
Right, just
that
published.
That was recently published. And you just mentioned that you were going to pick up his book, Chicago, and I love to read books about Chicago because I once lived there. Well, little did I know that I was going to, like you, get into a book that would completely absorb me in a way that I hadn't been for a long time. Because, you know what, it's just about ordinary characters. And I mean, the premise of the book is a boy graduates from Notre Dame. He moves to Chicago, has a job as a journalist with a Catholic newspaper, and he moves into a building on the north side of Chicago, and it's filled with these wonderful people and characters. And he lives there for 5 seasons, and he goes to White Sox games during one of their greatest seasons. And this is actually, I figured it out, it was the year 1979 because it was the great snow that happened.
Right.
And he mentions that it kicked out the mayor. And that was Mayor Bolandic of when that happened. And Jane Byrne came in.
Jane Byrne came in. And there's a lot of chatter
about Jane Byrne
among the characters in the book, too.
Yes. And he plays basketball with the Latin Kings. And it's very normal and nostalgic, and the characters you fall in love with, like the superintendent who never has gone anywhere from Chicago, and his best companion and helper is the dog, Edward. And
gave it away.
So
Edward is the most unforgettable character I've read about in a novel in years. Read this book for Edward.
You do need to read it. The thing is that I have to admit, the first pages he kept talking about Edward, and he says up front he's a dog. But I kept thinking I was missing it because I thought, no, Edward is a person. And I kept reading back and I said, no, Edward is a dog. And you're right. Edward is the best character here. Edward holds counsel for all of the dogs, birds, critters, that line up to come and talk to Edward.
He takes a day off every week
and holds court.
And and it's not Winnie the Pooh type at all. It's as if you are sitting in a diner talking with people. Long story short, this novel is called Chicago. If you've never been to Chicago, you'll have been there if you read this book. If you've been to Chicago, you'll be right at home. The author is Brian Doyle, who is a superb writer. Sadly, he passed away 2 years ago at a relatively young age, leaving a wife and a large family and some magnificent books. So write that name down, Brian Doyle, here on All Sides Weekend Books. We are going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Chris Hickey and Cassie Rose about your favorites. And then we'll welcome Dan Coyce and How to Be a Family. Don't go away. Thank you. are back, continuing All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Cassie Rose is here, WOSU's book critic, and Chris Hickey from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. And Chris, I would like you to offer us another quick pick. What's really hot right now in the library system?
All right, really hot right now is Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano. So this is a book about a boy. It's based on, she took the idea from a real incident, but Edward is the sole survivor of a plane crash.
Edward is not related to Edward the
this
dog in Chicago.
This is not a dog. This is a human boy.
Dear,
this is speaking of Edward.
Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. So she, in 2010, there was a 9-year-old boy in Libya who survived a plane crash, and that just got her thinking about what would that be like to be the sole survivor of a plane crash. And so she wrote this book. So Edward is now being called a miracle boy. And, people are weird with him. He's now living with his aunt and uncle. And he's trying to make heads or tails of what his life is going to be like now.
How old is Edward when we meet him?
He's 12.
12. Okay.
He's a 12-year-old boy. He sees his mother and other women, and that's both comforting and extremely painful. She also is telling the story of other passengers on the plane, and she's doing this simultaneously. So we're going back and forth between Edward's story and the story of some of these passengers. So it's an interesting character study just about different people. But the story does take Edward into adulthood when he tries to figure out what is his life going to be? You know, people are telling him you survived for a reason. He doesn't find that particularly helpful.
No.
He doesn't know what this reason is. What could that reason possibly be? But it is a really fascinating read. So if you like books with good character study in them, you'll enjoy this story.
It's called
Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano. It is one of our quick picks.
And it's getting a great deal of media attention as well.
Yes.
Very positive media attention.
Yes, it is a Read with Jenna Bush book.
Okay.
So she's been talking about that quite a bit.
Very good. Well, thank you, Jenna. But you hold nothing next to Cassie Rose, who is here, WOSU's book critic. You brought something called The Bear, which is also getting a lot of attention as well.
The Bear is by Andrew Krivok, and it comes out, I think, February 11th. And I love the work of Andrew Krivok. He wrote The Sojourn, which was, well, it's a great book. I'll just say that. And The Bear is being called a fable, which I hesitate to say that because that might drive people away when they would think, oh, it's academic. But it is so beautifully written. And it's about a man and his daughter who are the last two people on Earth. And they are living on this, it's Edenic. It's a paradise. I mean, the way he describes it, he doesn't go into this is horrible, this is negative. He just starts writing about this man and his daughter and how he teaches her how to survive, kind of like The Road, but without that dire sense about it. He teaches her how to live off the land and to shoot a bow and arrow. It's a kind of book that you want to read out loud. And because I sit there and I do read it out loud, and I imagine if you were reading it, you could share it with someone. And because of the voice, and it's so captivating. And there, the bear that is in it is, well, there are a couple bears that are in it. And you know that he's going to be working with this. And what happens is that the daughter gets lost. She's in an unknown area. And the guide that gets her back home is a bear. All of this is one of those books where you can't really explain it in a way that makes someone think, oh, my gosh, I've got to go read it. Because there isn't some tragedy in it or there isn't some big romance in it. It's a beautifully written book that makes you want to read it because Andrew Krivok is telling you something. In his background, too, I mean, he's an author. He is married, living in Massachusetts. But for several years in his early life, he was a Jesuit priest. And he has a viewpoint toward life and the world and the natural world that he brings to this book that I have a feeling comes from that experience.
This is called The Bear. It is a fable. I thought it was a poem. I thought it was a narrative poem, but it's not. It's written in novel prose form, in novel form.
Yes, and it's the story of this father and the daughter who are the last two on Earth, but he doesn't emphasize that. That's really just in the background. That's part of the setting.
That's just a hook. That's not really the point of the story.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You also brought a novel that the publisher just sent me that I haven't opened yet called This Is Happening by Niall Williamson. Could we talk about this a little bit?
Sure. It's This Is Happiness.
Happiness, pardon me. See,
yes,
I haven't written it yet.
it's by Niall Williams, who is an Irish author. This is a phenomenal book, story that takes place in a small parish in Ireland, just on the brink of getting electricity. Now, this is the 1950s. So now you have this backward community. They've been getting along just fine for years, and now electricity is coming. And a man comes with the team to install the electricity, and he changes a boy's life. And the boy is the narrator, but he's an adult now looking back on this time. And the agenda for the man to be here is more than really to install the electricity. He is here to ask for forgiveness from a woman that he hurt many years ago. So there are these two stories that are going on in this wonderful Irish environment, and all the folklore that comes in and the stories of the community, and it's beautifully written.
It also had gotten a great deal of attention, and it was sort of a... When I read the reviews, it was kind of a weeper in a way, but I don't get an impression from you. I get an impression that it's a stronger book than that.
Oh, it's much stronger. I didn't feel that it was a weeper at all. It is...
I mean, sometimes these books can get overly sentimental, and they get sort of pointless in a way and flabby, but not... The impression I'm getting is that's not true for this one at all.
Not at all. This is what I will sometimes call as a real novel. And by that, I mean it's got a well-developed story, well-developed characters. There is no hook in this to just say, I'm going to put a gun under the seat to make sure that I get you excited about this and wondering. It is about the characters, about this time back in the 1950s. And it is, when I say it's well written, I will tell you there is one of the best drunk scenes ever written in this book. I mean, epically, 6 pages long, it should go down in the canon of literature. Afterwards, this man is singing at the window of this woman who he's not even sure will recognize him. He's howlingly drunk. And the boy is watching this, and he feels he's got to interfere because the two adults are just not doing it well. And meanwhile, there's other stuff that is going on because of the electricity and the farmers that don't know how to really sign their name. And then the guys come to install the poles and they're backing out and saying, no, I don't think
and
so.
As you said earlier, we were doing just fine.
We were doing just
fine before you got here with your electricity and your plumbing and things like that. And, so this is a book set in rural Ireland in the 1950s, probably in Ireland that a lot of us grew up hearing about that no longer exists, really.
Correct. Yes.
The author is Niall Williams. I always look at your books upside down. That's why I have trouble. Thank you. This is Happiness by Niall Williams. I'll bet it's a quick pick. If it's not, it will be probably pretty quickly.
Potentially, yes.
So what other quick picks do you have for us, Chris Hickey? What books are people waiting in line to read? And if they're very lucky, they walk into the Whetstone branch or any branch, and there on the quick pick display is the book they want.
Yes. So here is All the Days Past, All the Days to Come by Mildred D. Taylor. So you may have read her famous book, Roll Thunder, Hear My Cry, which she wrote many years ago. This is the final book of that series. So even if it's been a long time since you've read that book, or maybe you've never read it, this is still a book that you can pick up and enjoy as a standalone. Because what Mildred D. Taylor does is she explains who the characters are. She explains the events that have occurred that have led them to where they are now. So you can really pick this up and enjoy this as a story. So this is about the Logan family, and Cassie Logan is the main character. So her family in Mississippi, her brother has now moved to Toledo. They've had it with the South. This is in the 1950s, pre-civil rights. And she follows him and decides she's going to go to school up north. And what they discover is that racism is still very rampant, even in the North. There's a situation where she goes to a movie theater and wants to sit down close to the screen. But no, she has to sit in the balcony. And well, why? There isn't any sign. There isn't any rule. Sits among the other people and is arrested. And a friend who intervenes, who's also an attorney, says to her, things are about to change, and we need people like you who are brave. Would you consider becoming an attorney? And she, laughs that off a little bit, but then, the wheels are turning, and she does start to think about that. And there's this sense of guilt where I'm up north where it's a little bit better, and my parents are aging, and they're in Mississippi. So there's a lot of traveling back and forth. And there's a lot of interest right now in the Green Book, and there's some new great nonfiction coming out about that. And so even though they don't mention the Green Book in this story, there's a lot of preparation that takes place to travel back and forth. They have to cook great amounts of food because they can't stop anywhere to eat. They can't stop anywhere to sleep, so they're taking turns driving. And it's and they know there's places they can't stop because it's just not safe. So there's a lot of preparation and a lot of thought process that goes behind all of the traveling that happens back and forth. I mean, for fans of that series, this is a fantastic wrap-up to that series.
Now, what is the series called again? That
you're the series, it's called The Logan Family. But Roll Thunder, Hear My Cry won the Newbery many years ago. This book has been long-awaited because the last book that she wrote in the series was in the late 90s. So it's been a while.
So 20 years later, we're back. Her name again is?
Her name is Cassie Logan. The author is Mildred D. Taylor, and the book is All the Days Past, All the Days to Come. I highly recommend it.
Some of us read a book like that and realize we have no clue.
Absolutely.
No clue whatsoever. I mean, I felt the same way when I saw the film of The Green Book, which was a book before it was a film, which I didn't know. I knew it was a true story. Mm-hmm. And you realize, being a middle-class white guy from a suburb, you just have no clue at all.
Right. And that's why we always talk about those window versus mirror books, where that window takes you into another person's life experience and you hopefully learn something about that.
Which
so this
I
is
think,
a good one.
Which I think that is what American Dirt, what the intention was for that.
So.
And that her intention was to open the window and to show people what is going on. But again, the execution of it failed.
And again, going back to that just briefly, because it's getting so much coverage and it's been in the news so much, American Dirt by Jeanine Cummins. You're saying that the writing did not convince you? Is that?
I have not read the book, but that is
that's
what they
the
are
premise.
Saying is
saying.
That, I mean, it's not just that it's bad writing. I mean, I can say that Peru Segal's, you know, she came out and she said, all right, the description of the characters, she uses, air quotes, the brown of the people. And she gives many instances of how she describes the skin color.
Oh.
And she says that it's inauthentic.
Okay, that's a key word, I think, right there.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where
you don't believe it when you're reading
you
it.
You don't, or because it's a page turner, readers forgive that kind of thing. So they're going to be caught up in the drama. It is where the people who have lived the immigration experience are aware of it, the experts, and also the Latin American authors who write about it are saying, why are you cheerleading this when we, in our authentic voices, write about it, but the publishing industry isn't?
Doesn't
you know,
in.
We get a $5,000 advance,
and you got to
be, what is it? So there is a brokenness in the publishing industry and an awareness. But there is, at the heart of it, I think, and if you listen to Jeanine Cummins, she was saying, my intention was good.
Yeah.
But she realizes she didn't carry it off.
She walked into a storm there, probably,
she didn't make.
Chris Hickey, because we have to let you go in a few minutes, I want to spend a little time on The River, the book that you and I talked about.
River is also a new quick pick, but The Long Bright River by Liz Moore. So this is about two sisters. Casey and Mickey, and they live in the Kensington area of Philadelphia, which is an epicenter of the opioid crisis there. So Casey is struggling with addiction. She is homeless, living on the streets. The sister, Mickey, is a police officer in that same district.
Okay, one quick thing. I'm in the middle of it, so don't give anything away.
It's
a real page-turner. Go ahead.
And it is definitely a page-turner. So we start out, the girls the women are not on speaking terms. But it does go back and forth between their childhood and who they are as sisters versus what is happening now. So the sister, Casey, has gone missing. And so Mickey, the police officer, is now obsessed with finding her because there's also a string of murders happening. And with her sister missing, you know, she's trying to solve this and find her at the same time. So this is definitely a page turner, but it's also essentially a book about sisters.
And it is, these are mean streets.
Yes.
These are very mean streets. And I think that is very convincingly conveyed. She's a cop. She's in that ethos. Mm-hmm. She can't really live in that ethos full time because she does have this sister who's on the streets. And there's a lot else going on. But it, if you want to really, it's an uncomplicated page turner. But it's, I don't want to say fun because there's a lot of sadness in the book. But it's not a sad book.
Right. So I think, you know, if you like a good mystery, if you like a good police procedural, this is for you. And if you're interested in stories about sisters, then you'll also find this book appealing. So it's going to appeal to a lot of different people. It'll be a quick read, enjoyable because it is a page turner and you know, a good mystery going on. I think people will really like it.
It'll get your attention. It's very engrossing so far, so I'm very much enjoying it. And apparently, it's a huge book club choice.
Yes, that's what I'm hearing.
It's a very big book club choice as well. I want to give you the opportunity, Chris Hickey, to give us one more quick pick.
Okay, so this one is not a quick pick, but I wanted to share how fantastic it is. So Jess Montgomery, she is a writer for the Dayton Daily News, and her book two of a series has come out. It's called the Kinship series. Book one is The Widows. Book two is the Hollows. The main character is Lily Ross, the first female sheriff in Ohio's history. She's based on the real first sheriff in Ohio's history, Maud Collins. Maud's husband was murdered, and she took over his post. And the same thing happens with Lily. So she's solving her husband's murder. And there's two widows. Another woman named Marvina is a widow. Her husband was a union organizer in the coal mines. He is killed in a mining accident. But the two of them come together. There's also a twist in there where the Marvina had a relationship with Lily Ross's husband.
Oh boy.
When they were much younger.
Mm. This
is called The Widows by Jess Montgomery. Fantastic story, great mystery, another page turner. Interesting history. You learn a lot about coal mining in southern Ohio. She writes about a community that doesn't exist. It's a made-up community around Vinton and Athens County.
Chris Hickey is Director of Youth Services at the Whetstone Branch at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. You go see her at Whetstone. She's always great to talk to, and she gets everybody going to the library no matter where you live in central Ohio, looking for quick picks and more. Thank you so much, Chris Hickey.
You're very welcome.
Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. We're going to continue in just a moment and welcome Michelle Herman from the Department of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University to our program. She will have with her from Slate Dan Coits. Don't go away. We are back with a special segment of All Sides Weekend Book. Cassie Rose is with us, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog, once again, thelongestchapter.com. Very important to anybody who loves to read. And if you don't love to read, why are you listening to this show? No, that blog is indispensable. Cassie Rose, thank you for continuing to be here. Michelle Herman is here, one of my favorite people, one of anybody's favorite people who loves the written word. Michelle is on the faculty of the Department of English and Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. She is an author and a ballerina, and it is delightful to have you here. And who have you brought with you?
I have brought my dear friend Dan Coits and my editor at Slate.
Dan Coits is an editor at Slate, and he has a new book out called How to Be a Family, The Year I Dragged My Kids Around the World to Find a New Way to Be Together. So my first question, Dan Coits, is are your kids speaking to you after this book?
They certainly are, although they have very choice things to say.
They're speaking to you. And are you still all together now that you're home?
We are still a family, yes. We survived an epic year away in four different countries. We survived maybe even tougher the process of me writing about it and telling all their stories to the world.
Now we're
doing great.
They knew you were writing this. Is that right?
They did, yeah. So I'm a journalist. I work at Slate. I've written for other outlets. And I also podcast about my family. I have a parenting podcast.
Oy, oh, my God.
at Slate. And so they're very used to the things that happen in our house becoming material. And so they were aware while we were on this trip, this is stuff that Dad could be writing about. They were aware that sometimes they would tell me, please don't write about this thing. But that was a known quantity going in.
Well, I want to say first off that I know now if I ever go to Delft in Holland not to go to school, first of all.
I mean, certainly not if you are not prepared to follow all the rules.
That's right. I wouldn't go to that. Michelle Herman, you have brought Dan Coyce to our attention. You brought him to Columbus where he is speaking at Denny later this afternoon. Is that right?
Yeah, at 4 o'clock today in Denny 311. Dan will be reading from the book and talking about it and answering questions and signing copies so you can buy your very own copy of this fantastic book.
You began calling me in November about this.
Yes, I
you
did.
Sent me the book. Why did you call me so much? I love the book. So what's the appeal to you?
Well, I really love the book. And as I told Dan, I think it's a much better book than it needed to be. It just needed to be an account of this kind of extraordinary year. But it's delightful. It's funny. It made me really angry at him a couple of times. I picked the book up and threw it across the room.
Yes, success.
I never got angry. I'm a guy. Why would I get it? I don't get it.
It's a very funny and sweet and loving book. And I also really love Dan. We go back, I don't know how many years. Do you know how many years?
Like 18 years.
A long time.
Yeah. A long time. So the premise is that you have two daughters, your wife and your wife, I believe, is an attorney.
She is. She's a First Amendment media attorney.
Okay, she's an attorney. You were living in the Washington, D.C. area, both of you in careers, both of you working probably 90 hours a week and, you know, nodding to the two kids once in a while. And you all decided to stop and live in four different places over the course of a 12-month period.
We decided to give our lives a hard reset and see how they do it in other places to see if maybe we could learn a little something about.
What were the four places?
We lived for 3 months in New Zealand, 3 months in the Netherlands, 3 months in Costa Rica, and 3 months in small town Kansas.
How did you choose where you were going?
It was a mix of wanting places that I thought could really teach us something about family life, something in particular that we were bad at. So, for example, a place like New Zealand, where family life revolves around the outdoors and nature and being out in the world. We're a very indoorsy family. We live on our phones. And so we wanted to challenge ourselves in that way. And then I also wanted to explore certain sort of foundational escape hatch fantasies that I think many middle-class and upper-middle-class parents have, that fantasy of leaving for the beach and just throwing it all away, or leaving for a small town where everyone knows you and life isn't as stressful, and to see if those fantasies actually held up to reality at all.
How old were your daughters when this was going on?
They were 9 and 11 at the time.
Preteen.
So, preteen,
yes. So still a little bit redeemable still.
Well, preteen means something different in 2018 than it did when we were kids. Preteen now means teenager well on its way to jaded adulthood.
Right. How did you get them, or did you ever succeed in getting their devices from their hands?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay. Yeah. That's impossible.
It turns out that's universal, and that was something that we saw everywhere we went. Every parent in every country in the world appears to be struggling with that right now.
Even New Zealand, out on the beach, they were doing
even
that.
Even New Zealand, I mean, they had tactics and methods to strip their children of their devices, and certainly those children would go out in the woods and enjoy that time to some extent, but once they got home, they had those same problems and arguments about phones that we did.
How different, now we're talking about geographic differences, weather differences, cultural differences, but in terms of being a parent and being a family unit, just transplanted to four different places, how different did you have to become, or did you become from place to place?
We tried to become very different from place to place. I mean, one of the lessons was that we never really stopped being ourselves. But at the same time, in New Zealand, we tried very hard to adapt to the very free-range parenting style of New Zealand parents, the way they don't keep close tabs on their kids at all, the way kids roam free around the neighborhood. So we tried to let our kids loose to do that, and our kids sometimes did succeed in letting themselves loose to do that. Other times they clung to us a little bit and weren't comfortable with that.
They did cling to you once in a while. I noticed that. So this kind of sort of unrestricted freedom in a way was alien to them or hard for them to deal with?
Well, it's certainly taking that kind of responsibility over their day-to-day interactions was new to them. You know, I don't even think of us as helicopter parents exactly, but we certainly manage and control and take care of an incredible number of things in our kids' lives. And so for them, for example, to be able to navigate conflicts with neighbors, with adult neighbors about stuff in our neighborhood in Wellington was new to them and something that they struggled with.
How about the people? How about the neighbors you met? Did they get what you were trying to do?
It depended on the place. You know, in New Zealand, we found that all the neighbors were very excited about this. There's a real tradition in New Zealand of being very excited to talk to everyone about how great New Zealand is. And then in some place like the Netherlands, where things are just done the way they've always been done, and it's a particularly insular culture, we would find that other parents would be mildly politely interested in what we were doing, and then within 10 minutes have nothing to say to us at all.
I got the impression in the Netherlands that the people were cordial, but they were not going to go out of their way to sort of embrace you as the new neighbor.
Well, it's not unfair, you know, right? We're only going to be there for 3 months. What is the upside to a very practical Dutchman of putting a lot of emotional effort into making friends with people who are just going to leave, especially when you as a Dutchman have already established, I already know how to be a parent. We have the best way of being parents
in the
world.
I know how. Yes.
I'm Dutch.
They may be right.
It is clear to me that, you know, as I write in the book, the Netherlands is the absolute best place to raise a family in the world if you've already lived there 10 years and speak Dutch. If you are just moving there, it can be quite awful.
Do a review for us, will you, about the schools in the Netherlands? Because it wasn't disturbing, but it was a little different in the course of the book, because you had just come from New Zealand, which was a little more laid back, which was an outdoor kind of life. And then you go to the school where you go to school in the Netherlands. It was like the nuns back in Boston in 1963, which I remember. It was not laid back at all.
It was extremely not laid back. Yeah. So, you know, we sent our kids to school in each of the places we went. We were not going to homeschool them. That seemed terrible. But in the Netherlands, we just, you know, I screwed up. In the planning of this trip, I found a school that I believed was a bilingual Dutch-English school. It turned out it was not at all. It was a monolingual Dutch school. Our kids don't speak Dutch, and the school is very regimented, like all Dutch cultural and social institutions, and it was not built to accommodate kids who couldn't speak the language and who also took a very American, argumentative approach to their own education.
Was it worth it to try to get them into a different school for 3 months, or did they have to just tough it out?
They just had to tough it out. And I mean, in retrospect, I now wish that I just let them stay home. And in one of the things that I went through in the book was coming to this realization that this thing that I had forced them to do was actively harmful to them. I think this is probably one of the moments that Michelle threw
the book across. You know, I'm very sensitive.
No, I know you are, but you didn't like the schooling, and you didn't like the school in the Netherlands.
But it's not just the school. I think she didn't like the way I handled that situation.
No, that's what it was. It really was. I was very happy with the Netherlands. I loved that they could ride their bikes.
No, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's a beautiful country. No question.
I mean, the thing about this book is, even though I know Dan, unlike most readers, but everyone's going to get this experience. It's like reading a novel, or you're entering into the world of a movie, and you're in it and you're with
right.
these characters. And I forgot that this was my friend who was treating his daughter so badly. I was furious. I couldn't wait for them to get out of the Netherlands and he redeem himself. I mean, who expected the book to get my heart rate up?
Well, except that I know that reading that, I knew I was an old guy when I was empathizing with Dan, who I don't know, and said, well, you know, yeah, you know, this is it. You know, you're make do.
Tough it out,
know.
Kids.
Yeah, yeah.
I kept thinking, homeschool the poor child. Why not? What's the downside to homeschooling her? And I just heard when we went by this, and Dan, and I know you didn't mean like, you know, we're not going to homeschool them because that was terrible. You meant what would be the point of homeschooling them, since this whole adventure was
to get
really
them
living in each place.
Yes, but also it would be terrible. I mean, we would just be terrible homeschool teachers, and I don't think they would enjoy or learn from the experience. And the book would have ended in a quadruple murder. Like, I just don't think that's what I wanted out of this project.
It would have been a different book.
Yeah. I mean, it probably would have sold.
I should also say that this has been named one of the best travel books of 2019 in the New York Times, which does mean something. So that's congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Because there's a lot to enjoy in this book and a lot to learn. I don't know if I could do it. I only have one child, and I don't know if I could begin to do it with two. So I congratulate you for that. Now, I was also interested when you wound up, I think your last port of call was Kansas. Hayes, Kansas, right?
Hayes, Kansas.
Which is a college town, is that right?
It has a small college in it. There's about 20,000 people in Hayes. It's in western Kansas, basically halfway between Denver and Kansas City.
And I want to point out that Dan now has the key to that city.
I do.
You do.
I was given the key to the city by the mayor upon my return.
Before or after the book was published?
And when I came back to read at the Hayes Public Library, I was given the key to the city.
I really want someone to give me the key to a city. I don't care what city.
I don't care
what
city.
I'm just out here putting it into the airwaves.
All right. Anybody with a city out there and a key, call Michelle Herman. Tell me about living in, you're back in the States where presumably everybody speaks English. So your kids are going to go to school and not have to speak Dutch, which they don't understand. They probably won't be going to the beach because there's no water in Kansas. But how was Kansas for them? How was that lifestyle for them?
For them, I think it read as very comfortingly familiar, right? They were returning to the United States where the TV channels were the same and where the internet always worked and where their classmates spoke English, as you say. For us, the the interesting thing about Kansas and the thing that I was most interested in exploring was, you know, we took this trip in 2017, right? The year after the election, a year when the divide between the East Coast where we came from and a red state like Kansas, for example, was not only felt starker than ever, but was also a subject of great angst and confusion among certain classes like my own, right? We were all very obsessed with what does it mean to have this divide between the coasts and the rest of the country, the Ohios, let's say. And so to explore that and to try to talk through some of those issues with the people that we met in Kansas, and, you know, Hayes is a tiny, tiny, slightly pinker oasis in a very red state, but it still, you know, voted about 78% for Trump in the 2016 election. And so watching the people that we met who became very close friends of ours, who we went to church with and went to school with and saw every day and sang with and did plays with, still very deftly sidestep those political conversations because the sort of cult of Midwestern niceness determined that they just would not get into it no matter what, was fascinating to me and frustrating, but yet extremely understandable.
That's interesting. So it never came up when they knew where you were from. Nobody ever asked you what your political persuasion might be or whatever.
No, they knew. I mean, I think no one was under any question as to what my political persuasion was. But I brought it up all the time. And I compare it in the book to, like, it's like when the guys tried to tackle Barry Sanders, right? He just does that move and then he's gone. That was what they would do, except conversationally. All of a sudden we would be talking about corn prices and I didn't know how it happened.
Little culture shock for everybody. The book is called How to Be a Family, The Year I Dragged My Kids Around the World to Find a New Way to Be Together by Dan Coyce, who is in town this weekend. He is reading at Denny at 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. Denny 311.
Denny is on the campus of The Ohio State University on 17th, which is now Annie and John Glenn Avenue. I had to look it up because, with all love to them, it's 17th Street. Okay.
It's 17th, and for those who are afraid of campus, you can park in the Ohio Union South lot. It's very easy, and then just walk across the Oval.
Now, you and I both know that had your wife not signed on for this, this trip would not have happened. You can rave all you want, but that's not going to happen.
That's correct. That's the way marriages work.
Did you have to really work on her for this, or was she sort of on board?
She was on board.
You really? Know,
she, at the time that we were making this decision, she was coming off a very, very difficult case. She represented Gawker in the Gawker versus Hulk Hogan case. One of the worst professional experiences of her career, and also just a bad experience for anyone who cares about journalism and the media in America. And she was feeling pretty frustrated about life and work and how she had spent 2 months in Florida working her butt off,
and she
only
was,
to watch this happen.
And she was working 22-hour days, probably, all the time.
And never saw her kids and was definitely in the mood for a hard reset. And this had been something that we had talked about for a long time, and having the opportunity to seize this moment and do it was, I think, very welcome to her.
What was the reentry like when you came home when all your journeys were done?
It was hard for us. Yeah. It was easy for our kids, I think. Although they did have some problems, as my wife suggested they would, and as I laughingly said, oh, they'll be fine. They did have some problems coming back to school with the stuff that they had missed and catching up in math. There were some dire academic moments, which they have basically gotten over at this point. But for us, the part of reentry that was hard was this sense that, well, we had gone on this trip and it was meant to transform our lives. And so what are our lives now that we're back in the house that we were in before? And we basically have pretty similar jobs to what we had before.
Did your wife go back to work to the law? Did she go back to a high pressure?
She went back to her firm, but under a different format. She started working less as on sort of a part-time basis, on a case-by-case hourly basis, as opposed to working on big litigation trials, mm-hmm. which was, I think, a welcome change for her. But I went back to my magazine. I went back to Slate, doing essentially the same thing that I did before. And one of the real lessons of the book was that, you know, that the transformation that we thought might happen, where we would end the year, you know, living on the beach in Costa Rica or working in yurts in Mongolia or going to medical school or who knows what, didn't happen. But that the small ways that we as a family felt like we understood each other because of that year we'd spent all up in each other's faces 24 hours a day really made a huge difference in our day-to-day life and the way that we just could be with each other.
And you understand the cable channels, and there's a lot to be said for that as well. Dan Coits, thank you so much. How to Be a Family is the name of the book. Highly recommended. Michelle Herman, as always, you said I should do this, and you were right. You're always right. I don't know why I argue. I don't know why I bother. Thank you so much, Michelle Herman.
You're very welcome.
Department of Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. Cassie Rose, There Is No Show Without You, the book critic for WOSU. Your blog is thelongestchapter.com. Thank you to producer Aaron Esmont and Matthew Rand. Thank you, Scott Good. Wonderful to have you back with us again, Scott. Thank you, Ann Fisher, as always, for everything that you do. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Good afternoon.